like, John said that Bill said that Bob is nice. Or even, John said that Bill said that Mary said that Bob is nice. But never sentences like, John said that Bill said that Mary said that Irving said that Bob is nice. The first sentence of this triplet has one level of embedding. The second has two, and the third has three. But the claim is that standard European languages never allow more than two levels of embedding. Therefore, they have hierarchy, one element inside another, but they do not have recursion, one element inside another, ad infinitum. According to Carlson's research, it does not appear that any SAE language is recursive. He acknowledges that one could argue that they are recursive in an abstract sense, or that they are generated by a recursive process. But such an approach doesn't seem to match the facts in his analysis. In other words, Carlson claims, to use my terms, that all of these languages are G2 languages. Carlson's work is, therefore, interesting support from modern European languages that G2 languages exist, as per the semiotic progression. Again, these are languages that are hierarchical but not recursive. To show beyond doubt that a language is recursive, we need to show center embedding. Other forms are subject to alternative analyses. A. Center embedding. A man that a woman that a child that a bird that I heard saw knows loves sugar. B. Non-center embedding. John said that the woman loves sugar. What distinguishes A is that the subordinate clauses that a woman, that a child, that a bird I heard, saw, knows, are surrounded by constituents of the main clause, a man loves sugar, and that a child is surrounded by bits of the clause it is embedded within, a woman knows, and that a bird is surrounded by parts of its matrix clause, a child saw, and so on. These kinds of clauses are rare, though, because they are so hard to understand. In fact, some claim that they exist only in the mind of the linguist, though I think that is too strong. In B, however, we have one sentence following another. John said is followed by that the woman loves sugar. Another possible analysis is that John said that the woman loves sugar. This analysis, proposed by philosopher Donald Davidson, makes English look more like Pirahá. The final type of language I am proposing in line with Peirce's ideas, G3, must have both hierarchy and recursion. English is often claimed to be exactly this type of language, as previous examples show. As we heard earlier, some linguists, such as Noam Chomsky, claim that all human languages are G3 languages. In other words, that all languages have both hierarchy and recursion. He even claims that there could not be a human language without recursion. The idea is that recursion is what separates, in his mind, the communication systems of early humans and other animals from the language of Homo sapiens. An earlier human language without recursion would be a subhuman proto-language, according to Chomsky. However, the fact remains that no language has been documented in which any sentence is endless. There may be theoretical reasons for claiming that recursion underwrites all modern human languages, but it simply does not match the facts of either modern or prehistoric languages or our understanding of the evolution of languages. There are many examples in all languages that show non-direct connection between syntax and semantics. In discourses and conversations, moreover, the meanings are composed by speakers from disconnected sentences, partial sentences, and so on. This supports the idea that the ability to compose the larger meanings of conversations from their parts, or constituents, is mediated by culture. As with G1 languages and people suffering from aphasia, Among many other cases, meaning is imputed to different utterances by loosely applying cultural and individual knowledge. Culture is always present in interpreting sentences, though, regardless of the type of grammar, G1, G2, or G3. We know not exactly which of these three grammars, or all three, were spoken by Homo erectus communities, only that the simplest one, G1, would have been, and still is, adequate as a language, without qualification. It should ultimately be no surprise that Homo erectus was capable of language, nor that a G1 language would have been capable of taking them across the open sea or leading them around the world. We are not the only animals that think, after all. And the more we can understand and appreciate what non-human animals are mentally capable of, the more we can respect our own Homo erectus ancestors. One example of how animals think is Carl Safina's book, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. Safina makes a convincing case that animal communication far exceeds what researchers have commonly noticed in the past, and other researchers have shown that animals have emotions very similar to human emotions, and emotions are crucial in interpreting others and wanting to communicate with them, wanting to form a community. Still, although animals make use of indexes regularly, and perhaps some make sense of icons, such as a dog barking at a television screen when other dogs are on the screen, there is no evidence of animals using symbols in the wild. Among humans, however, there is evidence that both Homo erectus and Homo neanderthalensis used symbols, and with symbols plus linear order, we have language. Adding duality of patterning to this mix, an easy couple of baby steps get us to ever more efficient languages. Thus, possession of symbols, especially in the presence of evidence that culture existed, evidence strong for both erectus and neanderthalensis, indicates that it is highly likely that language was in use in their communities. It is worth repeating that there is no need for a special concept of proto-language. All human languages are full-blown languages. None is inferior in any sense to any other. They each simply use one of three strategies for their grammars, G1, G2, or G3. Thus, I find little use for this notion, given the theory of language evolution here. The question of what evolved, therefore, eventually gets us back to two opposing views of the nature of language. One is Chomsky's, which Berkeley philosopher John Searle describes as follows. The syntactical structures of human language are the products of innate features of the human mind, and they have no significant connection with communication, though, of course, people do use them for, among other purposes, communication. The essential thing about languages, their defining trait, is their structure. The so-called B language, for example, is not a language at all, because it doesn't have the right structure, and the fact that bees apparently use it to communicate is irrelevant. If human beings evolved to the point where they used syntactical forms to communicate that are quite unlike the forms we have now and would be beyond our present comprehension, then human beings would no longer have language, but something else. Searle concludes, "It is important to emphasize how peculiar and eccentric Chomsky's overall approach to language is." A natural reply to this would be that what is one person's peculiar and eccentric is another person's brilliantly original. There is nothing wrong, per se, with swimming against the current. The best work often is eccentric and peculiar. But I want to argue that Chomsky's view of language evolution is to be questioned, not simply because it is original, but because it is wrong. He has continued to double down on this view for decades. In his recent book on language evolution with MIT professor of computer science Robert Berwick, Chomsky presents a theory of language evolution which furthers his 60-year-old program of linguistic theorizing, the program that Searle questions. Chomsky's view was so novel and shocking in the 1950s that it was initially thought by many to have revolutionized linguistic theory and been the first shot fired in the cognitive revolution that some date to a conference at MIT on 11 September 1956. But Chomsky's linguistic theory was neither a linguistic revolution nor a cognitive one. In the 1930s, Chomsky's predecessor, and I would say his inspiration, Leonard Bloomfield, along with Chomsky's PhD thesis supervisor, Zelig Harris, developed a theory of language remarkably like Chomsky's, in the sense that structure, rather than meaning, was central, and communication was considered secondary. And another predecessor of Chomsky's, Edward Sapir, had since the 1920s argued that psychology, what some today would call cognition, interacted with language structures and meanings in profound ways. In spite of these influences, Chomsky has staked out his claims to originality clearly over the years, reiterating them in his new work on evolution, namely that language is a computational system, not a communication system. So, for Chomsky, there is no language without recursion. But the evidence from evolution and modern languages paints a different picture. According to the evidence, recursion would have begun to appear in language, as we discussed earlier, via gestures, prosodies, and their contributions to the decomposition of holophrastic utterances. As speech sounds produced auditory symbols, words and phrases, these symbols would have been used in larger strings of symbols. Gestures and intonation, whether precisely aligned or only perceived to be aligned with specific parts of utterances, would have led to a decomposition of symbols. Other symbols could have been derived from utterances that had little internal structure initially, but were then likewise broken down via gestures, intonation, and so on. The bottom line is that recursion is secondary to communication, and that the fundamental human grammar that made possible the first human languages was a G1 grammar. Chomsky's grammar-first theory is disconnected from the data of human evolution and the cultural evidence for the appearance of advanced communication. It ignores Darwinian gradual evolution, having nothing to say about the evolution of icons, symbols, gestures, languages with linear grammars, and so on, in favor of a genetic saltation endowing humans with a sudden ability to do recursion. Again, according to this theory, communication is not the principal function of language. While all creatures communicate in one way or another, only humans have anything remotely like language because only humans have structure-dependent rules. 10. Talking with the hands. Small gestures can have a big impact. Juliana Margulies. Just as tacit cultural knowledge shapes grammars, it is also important in each of the latter's components. Words, gestures, phonology, syntax, discourse, and conversation. However, for many linguists and anthropologists, gestures are often omitted from discussion, judged too quickly to be secondary accoutrement of speech, a separate, independent facet of human behavior. But researchers from various theoretical perspectives have shown, to the contrary, that an intimate set of connections exists between hand movements, linguistic structure, and cognition, held together by tacit cultural knowledge. An analysis of the symbiosis between the hands, the mouth, and the brain, and how these evolved, has to round out any theory of language evolution. Additionally, some have argued that this all shows something more, namely, that the highly language-specific components of gestures are innate. This research, pioneered in the work of Susan Golden Meadow examines the spontaneous emergence of hand movements in children who have otherwise no access to linguistic input, as in the deaf children of hearing, non-signing parents. She calls these gestures home signs, and the gestural systems she studies might indeed be crucial to our quest to tease apart native versus cultural, or a priori versus a posteriori perspectives on the origins of some dark matter. To understand the role of gestures in language, it is important to grasp how they work together with intonation, grammar, and meaning. It is possible to get some idea of how these different abilities combine by focusing on gestures and intonation as highlighters, helping hearers pick out new or important information from old information that the speaker assumes to be shared with the hearer. One way to do this is to examine the evolving research into gestures and human language, from the ancients through the current and very important research of contemporary scientists. Without understanding gestures, there is no understanding of grammar, the evolution of language, or the use of language. Gestures are vital for a fuller understanding of language, its origins, and its broader role in human culture, communication, and cognition. Language is holistic and multimodal. Whatever a language's grammar is like, language engages the whole person. Intellect, emotions, hands, mouth, tongue, brain. And language likewise requires access to cultural information and unspoken knowledge as we produce sounds, gestures, pitch patterns, facial expressions, body movements, and postures altogether as different aspects of language. I want to begin here with an overview of the functions and forms of gestures in the world's languages, including, most likely, the languages of early Homo species. Gestures can be complex or simple, but they can be learned. The gestures that accompany all human speech reveal an intersection of culture, individual experience, intentionality, and other components of dark matter, or tacit knowledge. There are two kinds of knowledge of human grammars, as there are of most things, the static and the dynamic. These are quite possibly related to declarative and procedural memories, but they do seem a bit different. Static knowledge is a list of the things we know. Rules for telling stories are static knowledge. Dynamic knowledge, however, is understanding that things change and knowing how to adapt to changes in real time. If static knowledge is knowing the rules for telling a story, dynamic knowledge is telling the story. Gestures are crucial components for our multimodal languages. They are themselves intricate in structure, meaning, and use. Contemporary research makes it clear that gesticulations are as analytically challenging and as intricate in design and function as any other part of language. But, to reiterate, these are not simply add-ons to language. There cannot be a language without gestures. Most of these are used unconsciously and employ tacit knowledge. They are shaped by the needs of the language they enhance and the cultures from which they emerge. Kenneth Pike saw gestures as evidence for the idea that language should be studied in relation to a unified theory of human behavior. In a certain party game, people start by singing a stanza which begins, "Under the spreading chestnut tree." Then they repeat the stanza to the same tune, but replace the word "spreading" with a quick gesture in which the arms are extended rapidly outward, leaving a vocal silence during the length of time which would otherwise have been filled by singing. On the next repetition, the word "spreading" gives place to the gesture as before, and in addition, the syllable "chest" is omitted, and the gap is filled with a gesture of thumping the chest. On the succeeding repetition, the head is slapped instead of the syllable "nut" being uttered. Finally, After further repetitions and replacements, there may be left only a few connecting words like the, and a sequence of gestures performed in unison to the original timing of the song. Pike concludes from this example that gestures can replace speech. Later researchers, however, have shown that the gestures he refers to are a very limited type out of several kinds that are possible. Language is just a form of behavior, as gestures also are. Still, Pike's basic point is valid. Language and its components are human behavior guided by individual psychology and culture, dark matter of the mind. All human behavior, including language, is the working out of intentions, what our minds are directed towards. Language is the best tool for communicating those intentions. Communication is a cooperative behavior. It follows cultural principles of interaction. Pike raised another question. Why don't people mix gestures or other noises with speech sounds in their grammars? Why is it that only sounds made by the mouth can be used in syllables, and speech more generally? Why couldn't a word like slap be SLA pound symbol, where pound symbol would represent the sound of someone slapping their chest? It may sound easy, but really, this is not a possible word or syllable in anyone's language. As a beginning linguistics student, I thought this question was interesting, but did not appreciate adequately the degree to which it impinges on the understanding of language. Gestures aim towards what linguists and philosophers call perlocutionary effects, the effects that a speaker intends her language to have on a hearer. Speakers use highlighters in order to help the listener use or react to the information in the way the speaker hopes they will. To more fully illustrate the need for a single theory of culture and language, indeed all human behavior, one might contemplate a scene like the following. Two men are watching other men move some heavy furniture down the stairs in their apartment building. One man passing on the stairway landing is huffing and puffing and concentrating solely on his heavy load. His wallet is hanging loosely from his back pocket, about to fall out. He clearly wouldn't notice if someone relieved him of this burden. The first observer looks at the second observer with raised eyebrows, looking at the wallet. The second one sees him and simply shakes his head to indicate, no. What happened here? Is this language? It is a form of communication that is parallel to language. Certainly, shared culture and conventions are necessary for this kind of exchange. Just about anything two members of a culture wish to exploit can be used to communicate. There is a broad popular interest in gestures, though people often fail to recognize how fundamental they are to language. They formed the basis of a 2013 article in the New York Times by Rachel Donadio titled, "When Italians Chat, Hands and Fingers Do the Talking." Italians do indeed stand out gesturally, but so do we all. Even in the 17th century, Northern European Protestants disapproved of Italians' flamboyant hand movements. But the first person to study Italians, or any other language's, gestures from a modern scientific perspective was David Efron, a student of 20th century pioneer in anthropology and linguistics, Franz Boas. Efron wrote the earliest modern anthropological linguistic study on cultural differences in gestures more than 70 years ago. He focused on the gestures of recent Italian and Jewish immigrants, and later compared those with the gestures of second and third generation immigrants. Efron's study, Gesture, Race, and Culture, was simultaneously a reaction against Nazi views of the racial basis of cognitive processes, a development of a model for recording and discussing gestures, and an exploration of the effects of culture on gesture. The core of Efron's contribution is his description of the gestures of unassimilated Southern Italians and East European Jews, traditional Italians and Jews, recently emigrated to the United States and mainly living in New York City, though some of his subjects also came from the Adirondacks, Saratoga, and the Catskills. According to Efron, Italians use gestures to signal and support content. For example, a deep valley, a tall man, no way. The Jewish immigrants of Efron's study, on the other hand, use gestures as logical connectives, that is, to indicate changes of scene, logical divisions of a story, and so on. These uses of gesture underscore the fact that language is triple-patterned, symbols, structure, and highlighters, such as gestures and pitch, and shaped by culture. Efron wanted to know two things about gestures. First, are there standardized group differences in gestures between Italian and Jewish immigrants? Second, he wanted to understand how gestures change when an immigrant is socially assimilated. He discovered a strong cultural effect. An Americanization of gestures occurred in each group over time. The initially strong differences between Jewish versus Italian immigrants grew less pronounced until they were identical to any other citizen of the United States. Since his was a pre-video camera era, Efron contracted an artist to help him, Stuyvesant Fonfain. Efron was the first to come up with an effective methodology for studying and recording gestures, as well as a language for describing them. Although later parts of the book orthogonally attacked Nazi science, the book was a breakthrough. Efron's work, though pioneering, emerged from a long tradition. Aristotle discouraged the overuse of gestures in speech as manipulative and unbecoming, while Cicero argued that the use of gestures was important in oratory and encouraged their education. In the first century, Marcus Fabius Quintilianus actually received a government grant for a book-length study of gesture. For Quintilian and most of the other classical writers, however, gesture was not limited to the hands, but included general orientation of the body and facial expressions, so-called body language. In this, they were correct. These early explorers of gesture in human languages discovered that communication is holistic and multimodal. The Renaissance rediscovered the work of Cicero and other classical scholars, sparking European interest in the relationship between gesture and rhetoric. The first book in English on gesture was John Bulwer's Chirologia, or The Natural Language of the Hand, in 1644. By the 18th century, researchers on gesture began to wonder whether gestures might have been the original source for language. This idea is echoed by several modern researchers, but it is one that should be discouraged. Gestures that can serve in place of speech, such as sign languages or mimes, in fact, repel speech, as University of Chicago psychologist David McNeil has shown. They replace it. They are not replaced by speech, which would have to be the evolutionary progression if gestures came first. Interest in understanding the significance and role of gestures in human language and psychology diminished tremendously, however, in the late 19th and early to mid-20th centuries. There were several reasons for this decline. First, psychology was more interested in the unconscious than in conscious thinking during this period, and it was thought, erroneously, that gestures were completely under conscious control. Gesture studies also dwindled because linguists became more interested in grammar, narrowly defined by some so as to exclude gestures. The interest in the messy multimodality of language had waned. Another factor leading to the decline of gesture studies was that linguistic methods of the day were still not up to the task of studying gestures scientifically. Efron's work was extremely hard to do and wasn't amenable to widespread duplication, at least as many perceived it at the time. Not everyone can afford an artist. Linguist Edward Sapir was different. He saw language and culture as two sides of a coin. Therefore, his view of gestures was similar to those of current research. As Sapir said, "The unwritten code of gestured messages and responses is the anonymous work of an elaborate social structure." By anonymous, Sapir meant tacit knowledge or dark matter. This raises the fundamental and obvious question. What are gestures? Are sign languages gestures? Is a mime gesture? Are signals such as the okay sign with the thumb and forefinger or the bird with an upraised middle finger gestures? Yes, to all of that. Some researchers, such as David McNeil and Adam Kendon, classify all these different forms along a gesture continuum that looks at gestures in terms of their dimensions and their relationship to grammar and language. Figure 32, found in the bonus PDF. Gesticulation, the most basic element of the continuum, is the core of the theory of gestures. It involves gestures that intersect grammatical structures at the place where gestures and pitch and speech coincide. Gesticulation is, in fact, what most theories of gesture are about. Some gestures are not conventional. They may vary widely and have no societally fixed form, though they are culturally influenced. Gestures that can replace a word, such as Pike's chestnut tree language game, are language slotted. These can also be seen if you were to tell someone, "he," use of foot in a kicking motion, "the ball," where the gesture replaces the verb kicked, or "she," use of open hand across your face, "me," for "she slapped me." These gestures occupy the positions in sentences usually taken by words. They are special gestures. These gestures are improvised and used to produce particular effects according to the type of story being told. Fascinatingly, these language-slotted gestures are a window into speakers' knowledge of their grammars. One cannot use gestures unless one knows how words, grammar, pitch, and the rest fit together. Our hand movements can also simulate an object or an action without speech. When they do this, we are using mime, which follows only limited social conventions. Such forms vary widely. Just play a game of charades with a group of friends to see that. Conventionalized gestures can also function as signs in their own right. As I mentioned, two common emblems in American culture are the forefinger and the thumb, rounding and touching at their tips to form the okay sign, and the bird, the upraised, solitary middle finger. These are all distinct from sign languages. These are full-blown languages. They have all the features of a spoken language, such as words, sentences, stories, and even their own gestural and intonational highlighters. These are expressed in sign languages by different kinds of body and hand movements and facial expressions. In our discussion of language evolution, it is very important to keep in mind the most salient feature of gesture-based languages. That is that sign languages neither enhance nor interact with spoken language. In fact, sign languages repel speech, to use one of McNeil's phrases. This is why many researchers believe that spoken languages did not and could not have begun as sign languages. Now let's move to the crux of gesture's relevance for language evolution. The bedrock concept here, developed in McNeil's research, is called the growth point. The growth point is the moment in an utterance where gesture and speech coincide. It is where four things happen. First, speech and gesture synchronize, each communicating different yet related information simultaneously. The growth point is further described as that point where gesture and speech are redundant, each saying something similar in different ways, as in Figure 32 found in the bonus PDF. The gesture highlights a newsworthy item from the background of the rest of the conversation, again as in Figure 32. Intonation, it should be mentioned, is also active at the growth point and other places in what is being said. Third, at the growth point, gesture and speech communicate a psychologically unified idea. In Figure 33, also in the bonus PDF, the gesture for up occurs simultaneously with the word for up. In short, gesture studies leave us with no alternative but to see language not as a memorized set of grammar rules, but as a process of communication. Language is not static, only following rigid grammatical specifications of form and meaning, but it is dynamic, bringing together pitch, gestures, speech, and grammar on the fly for effective communication. Language is manufactured by speakers in real time, following their tacit knowledge of themselves and their culture. Gestures are actions and processes par excellence. The boundaries between gestures are clear, being the intervals between successive movements of the limbs, according to McNeil. Like all symbols, gestures, too, can be decomposed into parts. I won't go into these here, except to say that this all means that gestures, intonation, and speech become a multimodal, holistic system, requiring a homo brain to orchestrate their cooperative action. Another crucial component of the dynamic theory of language and gestures that McNeil develops is the catchment. This is a bit technical, but it is essential to understanding how gesture facilitates communication and thus the potential role of gesture at the beginning of language. A catchment indicates that two temporally discontinuous portions of a discourse go together. Repeating the same gesture indicates that the points with such gestures form a unit. In essence, a catchment is a way to mark continuity in the discourse through gestures. McNeil says, "A catchment is recognized when one or more gesture features occur in at least two, not necessarily consecutive, gestures. The logic is that recurrent images suggest a common discourse theme, and a discourse theme will produce gestures with recurring features. A catchment is a kind of thread of visuospatial imagery that runs through a discourse to reveal the larger discourse units that encompass the otherwise separate parts. Assume that while speaking, you use an open hand, turned upward with the fingers also pointed upward, whenever you repeat the theme about a friend wanting something from you. The gesture then becomes associated with that theme, highlighting the theme thereby and helping your hearer follow the organization of your remarks more easily. In other words, through the catchment, gestures enable speakers to arrange sentences and their parts for use in stories and conversations. Without gestures, there could be no language. Various experiments have been developed that illustrate an unbreakable bond between speech and gestures. One of the more famous experiments is called delayed auditory feedback. For this test, the subject wears headphones and hears parts of their speech on roughly a 0.2-second delay, close to the length of a standard syllable in English. This produces an auditory stuttering effect. The speaker tries to adjust by slowing down. The reduced rate of speech offers no help, however, because the feedback is also slowed down. The speaker then simplifies their grammar. On top of this, the gestures produced by the speaker become more robust, more frequent, in effect trying to take more of the communication task upon themselves. But what is truly remarkable is that the gestures stay synchronized with the speech no matter what. Or, as McNeil puts it, the gestures do not lose synchrony with speech. This means that gestures are tied to speech not by some internal counting process, but by the intent and meaning of the speaker. The speaker adjusts the gestures and speech harmoniously in order to highlight the content being expressed. Other experiments also illustrate clearly the tight connection between speech and gestures in normal talk. One experiment involves a subject referred to as I.W. At age 19, I.W. suddenly lost all sense of touch and proprioception below the neck due to an infection. Experiments show that I.W. is unable to control his hand movements unless he can see his hands. If he cannot see them, such as when they are below the table he is seated at, then he cannot control them. What is fascinating is that I.W., when speaking, uses gestures that are well-coordinated, unplanned, and closely connected to his speech as though he had no disability at all. The case of I.W. provides evidence that speech gestures are different from other uses of the hands, even other gesturing uses of the hands. Some suggest that this connection is innate, but we know too little about the connection of gestures and speech in the brain or the physiological history of I.W. to conclude this. In any case, however, this coordination comes about, gestures in speech are very unlike the use of our hands in any other task. One final observation to underscore the special relationship between gestures and speech. Even the blind use gestures. This shows that gestures are a vital constituent of normal speech. The blind's use of gestures has yet another lesson for us. Since the blind cannot have observed gestures in their speech community, their gestures will not match up exactly to those of the local sighted culture. And yet, this very fact shows that gestures are part of communication and that language is holistic. We use as much of our bodies as we are able when we are communicatively engaged. We feel what we are saying in our limbs and faces and so on. The connection between gestures and speech is also culturally malleable. Field researchers have demonstrated that the Arunta people of Australia regularly perform gestures after the speech. I believe that the reason for this is simple. The Arunta simply prefer gestures to follow speech. The lack of synchrony between gestures and speech is simply a cultural choice, a cultural value. Gestures for the Arunta could then be interpreted similarly to the Turkana people of Kenya, in which gestures function to echo and reinforce speech. Were gestures also important for Homo erectus? I believe so, based, once again, on the work of David McNeil. He introduces the term equiprimordiality, by which he means that gestures and speech were equally and simultaneously present in the evolution of language. There never would have been, nor could have been, language without gestures. If this is correct, claims McNeil, then speech and gesture had to evolve together. There could not have been gesture first or speech first. This follows because of my concept of triality of patterning. You cannot have language without grammar, meaning, and highlighters. By the same token, there could never have been intonation without language, or language without intonation. Once this initial hurdle of how gestures become meaningful for humans is overcome, the evolutionary story of the connection between gesture and speech may be addressed. McNeil's theory hypothesizes that early speech by the first speakers and human infants was holophrastic. That is, in these early utterances, there are no parts, only a whole. To return to an earlier example, say that the first utterance by an erectus was, "Shamalama ding-dong," as he saw a saber-toothed cat run by him, only 100 yards away. He was, in all likelihood, gesticulating, screaming, and engaging his entire body to communicate what he had seen, unless he was frozen with fear. His head and body would have been directed towards the cat. Later, perhaps he recreated this scene, using slightly different gestures and intonation. He is calm now. The first time, perhaps he uttered, "Shamalama ding dong," with hand movements on Shama and Dong. The next time, perhaps his intonation fell on "Shamalama ding dong." Perhaps his gestures remained over Shama and Dong, or, more likely, they were more closely linked to any change in his intonation. It is now possible that Erectus has inadvertently taken a holophrastic, single unit, utterance, and transformed it into a construction with individual parts. And this is how McNeil proposes that grammar began to emerge. As gestures and speech become synchronized, gestures can then show one of two characteristics. They either represent the viewpoint of the observer, the viewpoint of the speaker, or they represent the viewpoint of the person being talked about. And with these different viewpoints, different ways of highlighting content and attributing ownership of content, we lay the groundwork for distinctions among utterances such as questions, statements, quotes, and other kinds of speech acts. McNeil gives an example of one person retelling what they saw in a cartoon of Sylvester the Cat and Tweety Bird. When their hand movements are meant to duplicate or stand for Sylvester's movements, then their perspective is Sylvester's. But when their hand movements indicate their own perspective, then the perspective is also their own. Intentionality, being directed at something, is also a prerequisite to having a language. And intentionality is shown not only in speech, but also in gestures and other actions. We see it in anxiety, tail pointing in canines, and in focused attention across all species. One reason that gestures are used is because intentional actions engage the entire body. The orientation of our eyes, body, hands, and so on varies according to where we are focusing our attention. This holistic nature of expressing intentions seems to be a very low-level biological fact that is exploited by communication. The fact is, animals use as much of their bodily resources as necessary to get their message across. If we are on the right track, though, gestures could not have been the initial form of language. They would have occurred simultaneously with intonation and vocalization. This is not to say that pre-linguistic creatures cannot express intentionality by pointing or gesturing in some way. It does mean that real linguistic communication must have always included both gestures and speech. There are a few additional reasons for this judgment. First, speech did not replace gesture. Gestures and speech form an integrated system. The gesture-first origin of language predicts a mismatch between gesture and speech, since they would be separate systems. But in reality, they are synchronous. They match in time, and parts of a single whole. A gesture plus intonation plus speech coordinated in a single utterance. Further, people regularly switch between gestures and speech. Why, if speech evolved from gestures, would the two still have this give-and-take relationship? Finally, if the gesture-first hypothesis is correct, then why, aside from languages of the deaf, is gesture never the primary channel or mode of communication for any language in the world? Intonation was alluded to earlier when discussing, "Yesterday, what did John give to Mary in the library?" Whenever we speak, we also produce a melody over our words. If an example of the importance of intonation is desired, One need only think about how artificial a car's GPS sounds when it's giving directions. Although computer scientists long ago learned that speech requires intonation, they still have not produced a computer that can use or interpret intonation well. Intonation, gestures, and speech are built upon a stable grammar. The only gestures that provide stability are the conventionalized and grammaticized gestures in sign languages. In this case again, however, gestures are either used instead of or to supplant speech. What is crucial is that gestures co-evolved with speech. If sign language, language-slotted gestures or mimes, had preceded speech, then there would have been no functional need for speech to develop. The gesture-first idea stakes out an untenable position. We had a well-functioning gestural communication, but replaced it wholesale with speech. And some gestures, such as mimes, actually are incompatible with speech. This might seem to be contradicted by the earlier example from Kenneth Pike that apparently shows that gestures can substitute for speech. But the gestures Pike discusses are language-slotted gestures, a distinct kind of gesture parasitic on speech, not the type of gesture to function in place of speech. On the other hand, Pike's example suggests another question, namely whether there could be gesture-slotted speech corresponding to speech-slotted gestures. This would be a case of an output in which speech substitutes for what would usually be expressed by gestures. If speech evolved from gestures, after all, this is how it would have come about. And gesture-slotted speech is not hard to imagine. For example, consider someone bilingual in American Sign Language and English substituting a spoken word for each sign, one by one, in front of an audience. Yet such an event would not really exemplify gesture-slotted language, since it would be a translation between two independent languages, not speech replacing gestures in a single language. This is important for our point for a couple of reasons. The obviously utilitarian nature of hand signs offers us a clear route to understanding their origin and spread. And the fact that everyone seems to use gestures in all languages and cultures of the world is supportive of the Aristotelian view of knowledge as learned over the Platonic conception of knowledge as always present. This follows because it shows that the usefulness of gestures is the key to their universality. When a behavior is an obvious solution to a problem, there is no need to assume that it is innate. The problem alone guarantees that the behavior will arise if the mind is intelligent enough. This principle of usefulness explains most supposedly universal characteristics of language that are often proposed to be innate. In other words, their utility explains their ubiquity. As they stabilize by conventionalization, gestures become sign languages. But sign languages are formed when gestures replace all speech functions. The idea that speech develops from gestures thus makes little sense, either functionally or logically. The gesture-first theory gets the direction of evolution backwards. However, in spite of my overall positive view of McNeil's reasoning about the absence of gesture-first languages, there seems to be something missing. If he were correct in his additional assertion, or speculation, that two now-extinct species of hominin had used either a gesture-first or a gesture-only language, and that this is the first stage in the development of modern language, then why would it be so surprising to think that Homo sapiens had also used gesture-first initially? I see no reason to believe that the path to language would have been different for any hominin species. In fact, I doubt seriously that pre-sapien species of Homo would have followed a different path, since there are significant advantages to vocal versus gesture communication. There are still other types of gesture important in human communication. These include iconic gestures, metaphoric gestures, and beats. Each reveals a distinct facet of the gesture-speech relationship and its relationship to cognition and culture. There is no need to discuss these here, other than to mention them as evidence for the complexity of the relationship between gestures and speech, and that they each contribute to our progress along the semiotic progression. Nevertheless, we have yet to see anything in grammar, gestures, or other aspects of language that would lead us to believe that anything needs to be attributed to the genome of Homo sapiens that is specific to language. Cultural learning, statistical learning, and individual apperceptual learning, complemented with human episodic memory, seem up to the task. The literature is rife with claims to the contrary, namely, that there are phenomena that can be explained only if language is acquired at least partially based on language-specific biases in the newborn learner. It is claimed that there is a spontaneous emergence of language features in communities that are claimed to otherwise lack language, such as Nicaraguan Sign Language and El Said Bedouin Sign Language. These languages are purported to come into existence suddenly as a population needs language, but otherwise lacks one. The problem with this claim is that all of these languages begin with very simple structures and then become more complex over time with more social interaction. Often, it takes at least 3 generations to develop a complexity roughly equal to better established languages. But this is just what we would expect if they were not derived from innate knowledge, but invented and improved over time as they were learned by subsequent generations. For this reason, even if such examples provided some evidence for an innate predisposition to language, the knowledge would be very limited. Susan Golden Meadows' work argues that home signers develop symbols for objects, principles for ordering these, and constituents of distinct gestures. She also suggests that these newly minted gestures can fill slots in larger sentence-like structures, structures represented by the kind of tree diagrams we saw in the bonus PDF. She also discusses a number of other characteristics of home signs. Her conclusion is that all of this knowledge must be innate, or how else could it appear so quickly among a group of speakers? But none of these characteristics is specific to language. Indexes and icons, in all probability early forms of gestures, are used in one way or another by several species. There is no reason to believe that home signs cannot be learned easily by humans. In fact, on one interpretation, that is all that Golden Meadows' results on symbols show us, namely that children readily learn and adopt symbols. The object is a form with a meaning. As the child learns the object and desires to communicate, then, perhaps the most striking characteristic of our species, whether due to an interactional instinct or an emotional urge, the child will represent the object, and the meaning of the object in the particular culture comes along for the ride. Children participate in their parents' lives, even if without language, and try to communicate, as Helen Keller's remarkable Odyssey shows us. With an ability to see or hear or feel, the child can receive input from the environment, from its caregivers, and in fact will do so with most caregivers and in most environments. Learning the use of the object, the salience of the object to its parents and environment, it is unsurprising that children communicate about objects, as most other species, at least mammal species, do. Whole objects, as perceivable in a particular space in time, are most salient and learned relatively easily by dogs, humans, and other creatures. Humans try to represent their objects, unlike other animals, because humans strive to communicate. The fact that some features of the objects stand out to children is likewise unsurprising, though the particular reason that shape and size win out over many other features, if Golden Meadow is correct, is unclear. She ascribes it to the child's native endowment, but I would suggest looking first at the way that objects are used, presented, structured, and valued in the examples of the child's caregivers. Furniture, dishes, houses, tools, and so on are far more easily arranged and far more prevalent in the environment of U.S. caregivers' salient objects than other features.